This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Hurricane Rita made landfall this morning just after 2:30 a.m. Central Time. It moved ashore at the Texas-Louisiana state line, roaring in with winds of 125 miles per hour. That's a Category 3 storm. Now, at this hour, Rita, which is now smaller and less powerful than Katrina, is dumping water most heavily on Lake Charles, Louisiana. But Galveston, Houston, Beaumont, Lumberton, and Port Arthur, Texas in particular, are all feeling the effects. Areas of New Orleans, 275 miles to the east, are again underwater. We will follow Rita's movements and impact throughout the day. NPR's Joe Palca joins us in our studio and will be with us. Joe, thanks for being with us this morning.
Good morning.
And now down NPR's John Hamilton at the National Hurricane Center in Miami. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How strong is the storm? Where does it seem to be going?
Well, the storm has been losing force, as they do pretty quickly once they get on land. The last I heard, it was the forecasters here seem to think it was probably now down to a Category 2 storm with winds of more like 110 miles an hour instead of 125 miles an hour. However, earlier there was a report from Port Arthur of a wind gust of 116 miles an hour, which is a lot of wind. As for where the thing is headed, the tracking map here shows that it's headed up the east side of Texas. Eventually, it will head on to Arkansas. But the concern is that it's going to get up there in Texas and stop. And when that happens, it can drop a whole lot of rain.
Why would it just stop? And how is there any way of predicting?
Well, yes, there is. Hurricanes are kind of like a cork in a stream. They get carried along by what are called the steering currents, or you might want to just call the trade winds. You know, whatever the prevailing wind is carries them along, and when you see a place where those winds run into a high-pressure system or something which stops them, so does the hurricane. Mm-hmm. And that is what they're concerned about right now.
And so the attendant flooding could be fantastic, obviously.
Yeah, what happens when, I mean, a hurricane or even as it becomes a tropical storm, is dropping a whole lot of rain, and if it's moving quickly by you, it doesn't have a chance to drop that much, but if it just stops, it just keeps raining and raining, and they were talking about the possibility of 20 or even 25 inches of rain in some areas.
Mm-hmm. Joe Palca wants to get in here.
John, I just was wondering, they were predicting some pretty large storm surges from this storm. It weakened slightly as it came ashore. Were the surges as large as they were fearing?
I haven't got here any confirmation of that. There was the last I heard here, they were still expecting 15 feet of surge and up to 20 feet at some of the bays, the mouths, and rivers. You get some topographical features that can actually magnify the effect of surge in some places.
You know, I'm sure nobody wants to think about this right now, but we're still right in the middle of the hurricane season. Is there anything out there that we should be thinking about at this point?
Well, let's see. I think there's a storm called Jova somewhere near Hawaii. That's not likely to hit the East Coast.
Yeah.
And as always this time of year, they're watching waves signal the beginning of what could become a tropical depression, which could become a tropical storm, which could become a hurricane.
Mm-hmm. So to try and recap the story from where you can see it there, John, Rita is moving inland. The progress seems to be, let's put it that way, certain. They are concerned that the storm might at one point just sort of suspend itself over areas of Texas and Arkansas.
That's exactly correct. They're concerned that it's going to run into a high-pressure ridge and just stop somewhere there, actually probably before it reaches Arkansas, and that eastern Texas could get just a huge amount of rain with all the flooding that brings.
Well, we'll be back to you soon. NPR's John Hamilton is speaking with us from Miami. Thanks very much, John.
You're welcome.
Beaumont, Texas is in Rita's path, a few miles inland. NPR's Adam Davidson is in that city's Emergency Services Command Center. Adam, what's the latest from where you are?
Well, the power is out in all of Beaumont and most of Jefferson County here. The winds are extremely strong. We're told we're experiencing the worst of it and will for a few hours. This is an emergency command center, so it's running on generators. They do have some communications, but not a lot. They've been getting a lot of 911 phone calls from anxious people in the community who say their houses are collapsing, their roofs are blown off, they're very scared.
So the reports of damage and flooding that you're getting, can you describe for them what can people do in the command center at this particular point? Too dangerous to send out a car, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, they've made the decision to wait until dawn. There's some people who wanted to go out earlier. I think people are it's very hard for these people, firemen and ambulance drivers and policemen, to just sit around and wait. But they've determined they have to wait at least until dawn and until the winds die down a bit. So they're just telling people, stay as safe as you can. We can't come out. There is some relief, though, in Beaumont. The flooding that they were really afraid of does not seem to have happened. And they're just saying they just want the light to come up so they can go out and see what's left of their city.
Mm-hmm. And that will be coming up. As I look at the clock now, it should be coming up within the hour.
Yeah, hopefully within an hour or so. At that point, they'll measure the winds. They'll determine if it's safe. Yesterday, they said they wouldn't go out until the winds had died down to 50 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. But I think because of the frustration of waiting, they've decided to go out sooner than that, even if the winds are still hurricane force.
Mm-hmm. Adam, do you know much about Port Arthur, right on the coast near the point where Rita came ashore?
That is the source of real terror, I could say, here in Jefferson County. There are sketchy reports coming in, people calling 911. There are absolutely no emergency folks there. The police, the ambulances, the EMS folks, all the city officials left for here and for other safer locations inland. From what we have heard, and these are sketchy reports, we haven't been able to confirm them, obviously, there is severe flooding in Port Arthur. That is exactly what they expected and what they were most afraid of. There's also severe damage. So I think for this part of Texas, Port Arthur is really bearing the brunt of things. People here are very concerned about it.
So to kind of recap what you were able to get a hold of there in Beaumont, the storm surge that they feared in Beaumont has not yet materialized. Within the hour, it might be light enough and winds might have died down enough for emergency workers to begin to go out and try and find people who've called in distress. But Port Arthur seems to be the point of real concern now, and very little information coming from there.
Exactly. And since all the ambulances and fire trucks and police cars were taken far out of Port Arthur, even once dawn comes, even once the winds die down, it's going to take several hours for anyone to get there and tend to the people who were hurt or worse.
Okay, thanks very much. NPR's Adam Davidson in Beaumont, Texas.
Thanks.
The rain has reportedly stopped in New Orleans at this hour. Areas of that nearly empty city, which has been struggling to right itself after Hurricane Katrina, flooded again yesterday in the advent of Rita. The city could not escape Rita's storm surge. The lower Ninth Ward is once again flooded, as are areas near Lake Pontchartrain. NPR's Jennifer Ludden joins us from New Orleans. Jennifer, thanks for being with us, and how bad is the flooding right now?
Well, Scott, I'll tell you, it is still pitch black in New Orleans, so no one has gone out to see firsthand reports yet. The sun should come up soon. But already yesterday, I was out on the bridge overlooking the Ninth Ward, and it was pretty bad. I mean, water had surged over this industrial canal levee along the same 30, 40-yard breach that happened during Katrina. It was surging as far as the eye could see in that neighborhood. You know, some houses, it was clearly well into the first floor. Mm-hmm. And now this is an area completely devastated. For blocks, it was nothing but, you know, piles of broken pieces of wood and such. But then beyond that, homes still standing were also reflooded. An area to the north, again, roads were flooded over and water lapping into the doors of the homes. There was also a leak reported yesterday at the London Street Canal in another neighborhood, and we'll have to see when the sun comes up whether that expanded overnight.
Are the pumps working to be able to get the water out once again?
They're at about 40% to 50% capacity. They also were damaged during Hurricane Katrina. The Army Corps of Engineers says they'll, you know, do the best they can. But I think they estimate it will take 2 or 3 weeks. So it's quite a setback in the cleanup. And, you know, these areas had just about been dried out. So it's an emotional hit in a way. It's very demoralizing. I mean, the areas that were flooded have already seen water, but it just sets everything back.
Jennifer, what information have you been able to get there in New Orleans about what's going on in the southwest tip of the state around Lake Charles, where Rita has made landfall and they seem to be getting the worst of it?
Yeah, there's a lot of concern. You know, the local media is trying to call people, you know, have people call in from there, and I haven't heard any yet. But there is a report that police got a lot of 911 calls from areas that were to have been evacuated. You know, maybe people just were very frightened. We don't know what kind of damage there was. Obviously, people can't go in until the storm passes. The concern is that it's now stalled and more rain will fall in those areas, and it also delays the time that rescue workers can get in there. The one good news is that it doesn't seem that the rain will be as heavy as predicted. You know, if it at one point they were saying up to 25 inches. Right now, local meteorologists are estimating about 6 to 10 inches in Lake Charles. The one good thing is everyone's noting is that there certainly are a lot of rescue efforts well positioned now, much better than during Hurricane Katrina. You've got National Guard on duty to go in, and I think specifically about 4,000 Louisiana National Guard members who were here working on Katrina's recovery. They've now shifted toward Hurricane Rita recovery.
Well, NPR's Jennifer Ludden, we will be checking back with you today. Thanks very much for being with us. And NPR's Jennifer Ludden in New Orleans. Live coverage on Weekend Edition at 18 minutes past the hour.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, whose 86 employees in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick appreciate the support of WBUR listeners. They'll brake, shock, and exhaust you. DirectTire.com. And Amtrak, offering Acela Express and Metroliner for business travel in the Northeast Corridor. Daily departure information and reservations at Amtrak.com or 1-800-USA-RAIL.
From Boston University, this is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. Our weather forecast is calling for sunshine today. It's going to be cooler with highs only in the 60s. Tonight, it should be clear with lows in the 40s.
WBUR supporters include the Custom Homes at the Pine Hills, presenting a progressive feast featuring celebrity chefs of Boston Saturday, October 15th. Details at pinehills.com. And Landry and Arcari, supporting cottage industry rug weavers in India by helping to build looms in their homes and schools in their communities. Landry and Arcari of Salem in Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Coming up, should posse comitatus be changed? But first, we're following Hurricane Rita this morning. NPR's John McChesney joins us from Houston. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It's nice to be with you in the morning here.
And Rita made landfall east of Houston. Is it far enough away for Houstonians to feel that they've dodged the worst?
They have dodged the worst. This is the good news part of this story, if there is any. Houston, I'm standing in a parking lot here in central Houston, and we've had very light winds. I say light winds, 30 to 40 miles an hour, which is under normal circumstances not light, but compared to a hurricane, very light. And we've had very light rain. We're in some rain bands that come through periodically. We're in an area of Houston where normally during this kind of weather there's heavy flooding, and there is no flooding here at all right now. And in fact, I see no rain falling. The wind is just a mild gust. So Houston, as they like to say down here, dodged the bullet. And this is the major metropolitan area that was threatened by this. You know, over a million people were evacuated from this town in this area.
Yeah.
There are power...
Go ahead, John. Yeah.
There are power outages in some areas over toward the east, toward Galveston Bay, where there's a lot more exposure to the hurricane. And Galveston itself, Galveston Island, is without power. There was a fire there last night that destroyed some buildings, but basically Galveston, too, has escaped heavy damage.
Mm-hmm. Port Arthur does seem to be the point of concern at the moment, and a lot of that remains inaccessible. We don't have people who are able to talk on even sat or cell phones there, as a matter of fact. Have you been able to hear anything from authorities there about Port Arthur?
No, not in terms of the damage to the refineries. You know, we have over a quarter of America's refinery capacity concentrated there, and we really don't know what the damage is to those refineries in that area. There is some report that a barge broke loose and is hammering a bridge, one of the major highways up in that area, but it's we have fuzzy information on that. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that's going to happen here is people are going to hear that Houston is not seriously damaged and are going to want to get back home. You know, we've had so many people out of here. The problem with that is we have no gas in this area, or if not no gas, very little gas. I was out yesterday and people were piled up at gas stations, the few gas stations that had any gasoline here. It's very, very difficult to get enough gasoline to get around, and a lot of people are still probably spending the night in their cars up along these highways.
You know,
I just wonder
in the 30 seconds we have left, as you've been able to talk to officials there, the evacuation of Houston was successful, but protracted and taxing. And I wonder if officials there are worried that the next time they have to evacuate the city, and we're still in the middle of hurricane season, a lot of people in Houston are going to say, I'm not going to go through that again.
Well, I think that is a danger. I mean, someone said last night to me, you know, it's always about the last hurricane. This one's about Katrina. Everybody got out because of Katrina. Next time, will they go? Who knows? Because they didn't get hit, and it's a major undertaking to get out on those highways.
NPR's John McChesney, who's in Houston, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
And in anticipation of Hurricane Rita making landfall, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has prepared 4 days worth of food, water, and ice in Texas and Louisiana. The Pentagon has added 13,000 more troops to strengthen the National Guard presence throughout the region. Jane Bullock is a former chief of staff at FEMA and worked for the agency for 22 years. She joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
And NPR's Jill Palka is joining us all throughout the morning. What are emergency services doing right now, perhaps as a consequence of going to school on Hurricane Katrina a few weeks ago?
Well, I think they made a major change in how they operated in terms of pre-deploying assets. I think they're now getting ready to bring generator packs in so that they can get electricity up and running in critical facilities. I think they're ready to go in with search and rescue teams, especially in places like Port Arthur, mm-hmm. which was very badly hit. I think you've seen how the agency operates when it has the advantage of having the pre-deployment there.
Yeah. And having had the advantage of finding out what can go wrong or something, it's hard to refer to it as an advantage, but a failure is often the best teacher.
Well, it is. And I think, too, that we had, once again, we had time to prepare for this storm. We knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. And this storm and this hurricane is much more similar to previous hurricanes in terms of it being a rain event. Mm-hmm. We have found hurricanes more and more, with the exception of Katrina, becoming flooding events, not wind events.
How hard-pressed is FEMA going to be in the weeks that follow to be able to provide services?
Scott, that's a good question. I think the resources of the agency have been strapped. It's been reduced in its resources. I think it's going to have a hard time getting the recovery going. We've already seen some problems with the recovery with Katrina. I think there has to be an emphasis on giving the agency back its resources so we can move on to recovery.
Mm-hmm. Joe Palka.
Well, I'm just wondering if there's an advantage financially for getting the material in place, even if you wind up not using it. I mean, does it actually save money to prepare in advance this way, or do you have to spend the money either way?
Well, I think it does pay in advance, especially when you're talking about search and rescue teams, and you're talking about no matter how minor the storm is, you're going to need ice, you're going to need water, you're going to need those kinds of supplies. So it makes sense to do it in advance.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask follow-up on what we were speaking with John McChesney about in Houston. They got a lot of people out of town, but people were in their cars for 20 hours. There were people who died during the evacuation. Something that people don't like to talk about, I'm certain, is that when people come back to Houston, they'll find some areas that had been looted. People who left their homes will find that they've been damaged in other ways, because not everybody did get out of town. Is it hard when you have the evacuation of a major city to make the case to do it time and time again during hurricane season?
Well, I think that's an education issue we have to work with the public on. You know, Hurricane Floyd in the 1990s, we did evacuate 2.6 million people, mm-hmm. and there was no looting because people understood. It was very well organized. I think what we have to do is begin to look at how we do evacuations, maybe relook the scenarios we use, and also look at pre-positioning gas along the way so people don't run out of gas, making sure that people understand that there'll be troops, there'll be military assets in their hometown, watching their businesses, watching their homes. Mm-hmm. We have to re-educate people. But it is a concern. You know, people tend not to go the second time.
Yeah. New York Times had a story this week, or reported this week, that among many other things that could be reported, a number of years ago, I think when you were in FEMA, $500,000 was given for levee repair that the local officials wound up using to build a highway. Their argument was, well, we'll need highways to evacuate the city. That part went well, but of course the levee part didn't go well at all. How do you work with local agencies to create what amounts to a regional sense of security?
Well, I think what we've learned from these storms is we have to refocus our priorities on looking at natural hazards again. Mm-hmm. You know, for the last 4 years, we've been concentrating on terrorism, which is certainly a hazard, but we really have to look at how we deal with the things that we will face every single year, such as bad hurricanes, such as floods. And I think we have to relook the book. We have to look at how we can do more efficient evacuations and work more closely with state and local partners. You know, the system is broken.
Okay. Former FEMA Chief of Staff Jane Bullock, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
President Bush is monitoring Hurricane Rita at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado. That's the seat of the recently created U.S. Northern Command that's providing military and logistical support as the storm bears down on the Gulf Coast. Last week, when he spoke to the nation from New Orleans, Mr. Bush said Hurricane Katrina underscored the need to revise rules on how the military responds to such emergencies.
It is now clear that a challenge on this scale requires greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces.
In the Congress, some of the president's allies are specifically calling for a review of the law barring the military from doing law enforcement duties, the 127-year-old Posse Comitatus Act. More from NPR's David Wellner.
Last week, John Warner, the Republican chair of the Armed Services Committee, rose in the Senate and made this proposal.
The time has come that we should just reflect on the Posse Comitatus Act and other statutes which have stood by and served this nation quite well in years past.
Congress enacted Posse Comitatus in 1878 at the end of Reconstruction. It did so to assert greater control over federal troops deployed at polling places by county sheriffs in the South. The law forbids using active duty federal troops for searching or arresting civilians or seizing their property unless authorized to do so by Congress. Such law enforcement, said Senator Warner, should normally be done by civilians.
But sometimes, and this may be one, we'll have to examine the facts, they become so overwhelmed or so incapacitated by a natural disaster or perhaps a terrorist attack that the armed forces may have to perform some of those duties. So we want to make sure that the president has that flexibility.
I hate to say it, but I'm thinking that maybe even some of the senators and so forth who are calling for this don't really realize what the Posse Comitatus Act does.
McCubbin Owens teaches national security at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and is writing a history of civil-military relations in the U.S. He fears an apolitical military could become politicized and resented if it's too easy for a president to waive Posse Comitatus.
My real problem is we start getting this idea that, well, the military is just another tool that we ought to be pulling whenever anybody in the United States thinks something's too hard for everybody else to do. It's just going to get the military away from what it should be doing.
Others are alarmed by what a revision of Posse Comitatus might mean for civil liberties. Senator Tom Harkin is an Iowa Democrat.
This whole idea of empowering military and stuff to do normal police function is anathema to American freedoms and to our American system.
Tim Edgar of the American Civil Liberties Union agrees. Army troops, he says, are trained to kill.
The danger is that the military in general are not trained, and it's not their constitutional function to enforce the law against American citizens and residents with respect for constitutional rights and freedoms.
Congress has already lifted some restrictions on Posse Comitatus in recent years. Troops can now be used in counter-narcotics operations. They can also respond to weapons of mass destruction attacks. And as House Armed Services Chair Duncan Hunter points out, National Guard troops already can do law enforcement when they're under a governor's command.
So I don't know if we necessarily need to change this law to make National Guard any more effective in disasters.
Similar caution regarding Posse Comitatus is being sounded by Republican Senator Susan Collins, who heads the Homeland Security Committee.
We've agreed that it does need review, but it needs careful review. That would be a major policy change, and I think we have to proceed carefully.
Other lawmakers are urging that before any changes are made to Posse Comitatus, a thorough and some say independent investigation must be done. to know if laws or humans are to blame for what went wrong in the response to Katrina. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
And here is the latest news as Hurricane Rita continues to move inland. The storm made landfall early this morning, a little after 2:30 this morning Central Time, and is currently pounding communities along the border between Texas and Louisiana, including Lake Charles, Louisiana, and Port Arthur, Texas, with drenching rains and winds in excess of 100 miles per hour. The Category 3 storm came ashore east of the huge oil refining centers of Beaumont and Port Arthur, with sustained winds topping 120 miles per hour. Hurricane-force winds extended up to 85 miles from the eye, which had the effect of uprooting trees and downing and damaging hundreds, perhaps thousands of homes and buildings. A 20-foot storm surge is expected along the coast of Louisiana. In Vinton, Louisiana, that is 10 miles west of Lake Charles, police have reported that several homes and buildings are on fire, perhaps from broken gas mains. Houston and Galveston, which had evacuated their populations, were spared a direct hit from this powerful storm, but of course they will not be spared much wind and much rain damage, and perhaps much flooding as Hurricane Katrina continues to move inland, continues to move up the coast, and now there is concern that the storm at some point is going to stall, which will have the effect of swirling wind and rains in parts of Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas. We are going to continue to follow the news of Hurricane Rita as it moves inland this morning on Weekend Edition and other NPR news programs. And you're listening to live coverage on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
As Hurricane Rita ravages the Gulf Coast and soaks New Orleans once again, the almost 200 Hurricane Katrina evacuees now living on Cape Cod are closely monitoring the storm. Reverend Jeffrey Brown, the pastor of the Union Baptist Church in Cambridge, has been coordinating the evacuees at Camp Edwards, and he joins us to talk about their reaction to Rita. Reverend Brown, how are the evacuees monitoring Hurricane Rita? Can you describe that? Is there one sort of main gathering spot at the camp where people can get information?
Well, as I was walking through the dorms and looking at the televisions at the common rooms, rather than seeing other television programs, all the TVs were focused on the news programs and CNN, CNBC, and everybody was looking at the storm's progress.
I imagine it must be quite emotional for many of them to see that Hurricane Rita's storm surges cascading over levees that were repaired from Hurricane Katrina. Is there also a sense of gratitude, maybe, that they didn't stay in the area and that they are in New England?
Well, I think there is a lot of gratitude, and there's also some frustration. If you notice that waterfall cascade is going into the Ninth Ward, and many, I think, most of our residents are from the Ninth Ward area. And so for some that had been thinking about going back home, that's a little frustrating. But you're right, there's a lot of gratefulness and gratitude that they are safely away, but some are still anxious about loved ones.
Hmm. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has said that Camp Edwards could house another 800 evacuees from Hurricane Rita. What would have to be done at Camp Edwards to accommodate that many more people?
Well, we're actually set up for that particular number. I believe that we're always ready for anyone who has experienced this kind of devastation. We would have to ramp up again the welcoming station that we had set up, but that could be quickly done. If there's anyone who, as a result of the storm, loses everything that they have or find themselves in dire straits and need to be transported out, Massachusetts stands ready to help them.
The state of Massachusetts is opening 3 disaster relief centers next week to help the evacuees. What do you think they need the most right now?
Well, we have hundreds of people coming as a result of the Katrina disaster into Massachusetts. We have approximately 200 down on the Cape, but there's another estimated 600, or a little over 600, that have come into Massachusetts as a result of the Katrina damage. They need some of the same kinds of benefits that our friends on the Cape have received from FEMA and from the Red Cross. All of the services that we have down there, they need as well.
I'm wondering, I know we're still in the middle of it here, but when you look at how this has been handled and what's been happening at Camp Edwards, is there a lesson or a message that you sort of take from it all?
What I take from it is that we have been blessed.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Coming up, the Dixie Cups, now without a home. Time now for sports. Hurricane Rita is denying the Gulf Coast region their beloved distraction. Some might even call it a religion. Many college football games have been canceled or postponed this weekend, continuing a season that's already been mightily disrupted by Hurricane Katrina. Ron Rappaport joins us now from Chicago. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
The LSU-Tennessee home opener has been moved twice now. First
exactly.
Katrina, now when's it going to be played?
Well, they're going to play it Monday night. You know, they wanted to play it today, and the LSU maybe they suggested tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Tennessee was talking about forfeiting the game, which, as you point out, in Southern football is, you know, those two words just don't go together in the same sentence. But they've moved it till Monday, and normally this would be one of the big games on today's college schedule, the third-rated team in the country against number 10. I think everybody's just hoping that things calm down to the point where people can enjoy going to a game with a clear conscience, you know.
Yeah, exactly. We'll note here that, let me see, Southern University in Albany State won't play this weekend because of Hurricane Rita's impending arrival and the schools couldn't get together on a time. The game time for Mississippi State, Georgia, scheduled, has been changed to 6:45 p.m. It's really playing, this is the least of the damage of the storm, but it's really playing havoc with the schedule and certainly the concerns of players, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I'm not sure we can, it's been very fluid the last 48 hours. I'll tell you, for instance, when Texas A&M beat Texas State in College Station Thursday night, that was a game that was moved up 24 hours. Scott, they told their fans to stay home, and most of them did, while the traffic from the evacuation from the coast was streaming by outside. They gave away rain checks. That might be a first in college football.
Mm. Let's talk about the Major League Baseball season, because we're heading towards the close of the season, and there are close races, particularly for the wild cards. Look, ever since we talked about the Chicago White Sox being the best team in baseball, they have been just about the worst. They were once 15 games ahead of the Cleveland Indians. They're now just 1.5 games up on the Tribe, and the Indians are very hot. Are the White Sox on the verge of what would be the biggest collapse in baseball history?
They're driving us crazy here in Chicago. I mean, you know, this is a town that knows what suffering is all about. If they were to blow this 15-game lead, which they had on August 1st, it would be the worst collapse by any team in Major League history. Nobody's ever blown a lead that big. Now, they won last night, finally, but they're still only a game and a half again ahead of Cleveland, which just seems like they're never going to lose again. Scott, you've been in Chicago. You've lived here. I'm not sure the White Sox could open for business next year if they blow this.
Well, I was actually in Chicago earlier this week. Saw a game, by the way, sitting next to Jerry Springer. I don't mind. I don't mind dropping a name. Together, we brought them victory in the 10th inning. But I tell you, White Sox fans will say, we're not Cub fans. We don't find losers lovable. We're not going to embrace these guys. Back up the truck. Get out of town if they can't win.
No, they're booing Ozzie Guillen and the players now. And this is a team that's in first place and supposed to be on their way to the World Series. They are not taking this collapse at all well.
The Bo Sox and Yankees are going to go to the wire, aren't they?
It looks like it. The Yankees have now won five straight, and they're leading the division by a game, and they're leaving Cleveland and Boston to fight it out for the wild card. So the Yankees look tough. They're winning when they have to, and with all the money that George Steinbrenner is paying them, they better win.
And isn't it interesting? You can have teams that will just fall, that perhaps will fall a game short of winning the division, that have no chance of winning the wild card.
Yeah. Well, that's what baseball is about at this time. Everybody loves to play the role of spoiler, a team with a losing record to knock a good team out of the playoffs.
Well, thanks very much. Ron Rappaport is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times and our sports guy here on Weekend Edition. Weathering Hurricane Katrina and Rita has been an exhausting balancing act for the New Orleans Police Department. There are more than 1,700 officers on the force. Nearly 80% of them have lost their homes when floodwaters inundated the city, but still managed to save thousands of residents. Now the New Orleans Police patrol an empty and devastated city, NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
It was early in the morning Thursday when hundreds of police officers walked down a ramp leaving their temporary home, a cruise ship docked on the Mississippi River. Due to the approaching Hurricane Rita, the ship was moving out of New Orleans for several days.
Do you know where you go from here?
No, ain't that something?
And it's just police leaving?
Yeah. Yes.
Where many of the officers end up is at a hotel down the street. In their dark blue police T-shirts, they surround the desk sergeant who's taken over the hotel's bell stand. He shouts out names and gives the officers keys to their rooms. The hurricanes have made the search for temporary housing frustratingly commonplace. Superintendent Eddie Compass says it's not only been a job to find lodging for personnel, but also for the department since Hurricane Katrina and the floodwaters that followed severely damaged a number of police buildings.
Well, one of the main challenges we have is to find some type of physical structure so we can come back to have a semblance of a police department, whereas we're going to have some type of central location, some type of headquarters where it can be housed at, or you can go on a day-to-day basis, you know, day-to-day working basis as a police department.
The department also lost half of its vehicle fleet, 600 to 700 cars. Other police agencies and the military have helped the department survive. The Louisiana State Police and Delaware donated vehicles. The National Guard and officers from other towns helped conduct search and rescue missions. The department's new command central is housed at the elegant Royal Sonesta Hotel in the French Quarter. The crystal chandeliers in the hallway, a stark contrast to the quarter's debris-filled streets. Captain Marlon DeFillo sits at a table. The police department spokesman lost his home in the flood, but his blue uniform looks crisp and freshly pressed.
A lot of the uniforms are donated. We have uniforms from around the country. We have military fatigues. I just got this yesterday, what I'm wearing today. And prior to that, I was wearing army fatigues and a T-shirt. We're starting to try to get everyone in similar uniform.
It is an effort to return to normalcy. In many ways, the department has. There's roll call and regular street patrols of the evacuated town. However, there have been some problems. Hundreds of officers didn't show up for work for days after the hurricane. Some resigned. Others face hearings. There have even been charges of officers looting vacant homes. Superintendent Compass says in many instances, the police were simply recovering stolen property.
If we find that any of our officers are in violations and any type of proof that these acts did take place, they will be punished.
The chairman of the New Orleans Police Foundation has only praise for the police. John Casbon says many of the officers have lost everything and still remain on the job. He wants to make sure the police force remains intact and that officers receive the financial help they need to care for themselves and their families.
We got to rebuild. The New Orleans Police Foundation for 10 years, a decade, has been dedicated to making sure that the police officers had everything they needed. And even though budgets are supposed to do that, they just don't. They always fall short.
And now New Orleans is a city on lockdown without a revenue base. The foundation is looking to raise money, $10 million, from private donations and corporations for police and other groups. It will be a morale booster for a department that has struggled through the city's catastrophic disaster and a boon to many of the police officers who say they are just now beginning to think about rebuilding their own lives. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, New Orleans.
Among the many artists who raised money for hurricane relief at Madison Square Garden and Radio City Music Hall this week were the Darlings of New Orleans, a pop music trio known as the Dixie Cups.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married.
Sisters Barbara Ann and Rosalie Hawkins and their cousin, Joan Marie Johnson, were the young women who put Chapel of Love on the top of the charts in 1964. The Dixie Cups were performing in Las Vegas when Hurricane Katrina flooded their homes in New Orleans. That loss puts them on tour indefinitely. Barbara Ann And Rosalie Hawkins joins us now from the studios of member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, my word. How do you interview two sisters who have voices that sound so much alike? Well, may I ask you, every now and then say, this is Barbara Ann Hawkins, or this is Rosalie. Or I could cheat and just call you both Ms. Hawkins, couldn't I?
Okay. That would be cheating.
Yeah. How did you folks wind up in Tampa, may I ask? Barbara Ann?
Okay. Rosa's son, my nephew, lives here with his family. So we came here to see about him.
And how are your families, Rosalie Hawkins?
They're doing a lot better than we are. We're kind of floating in the air right now.
Yeah. May I ask, do you know what condition your homes are in?
Well, the area that we live in, New Orleans East, was underwater. We don't know how much, but it was under.
I'm just guessing you have pictures and memorabilia and programs.
Had, past tense, had pictures and memorabilia.
All of that.
All of that is in our home.
It's still in our home.
Oh, my. And you just have no hope that any of it survived, maybe on an upper
floor
or something?
No. If it got to the second floor, this is Rosa speaking, I did pack up a lot of the photo albums and CDs and everything in one of these crates that you get from Walmart, and I had a top on it. You know, we're in the same boat, you might say, that every other New Orleans person is in, just about. Mm.
Let me ask, you played at a benefit concert along with Jimmy Buffett, John Fogerty, Elton John, Simon and Garfunkel, the Neville Brothers. I mean, I don't think it's any secret. Elton John and Paul Simon, they can afford to do benefits.
Correct. But, so can some of the others.
But a lot of New Orleans musicians need to work for a living, don't they?
Yes,
exactly.
We do. And we've done weddings. We've sang for the bride to walk up the aisle. We do have a band, and we know where everyone is, so we need work, really.
Except our horn player.
Joe Salisbury.
Okay. Joe
Salisbury. We're trying to find him.
We're trying to find him. We can't find him.
He was in New Orleans?
Yes.
Yes.
And how many times would you estimate you've sung going to the chapel?
Oh, my God. I can't. I can't count.
Never enough times.
Is it hard for you to watch the news?
Let me tell you what I really thought about. I said, you know, most of the people are out of New Orleans. It's ruined already. I said, I would not mind if the hurricane would go to New Orleans so that the people in Texas would not end up the way we are, devastated, losing things, losing lives.
May I ask? By the way, I don't want to lose sight of your cousin, Joan Marie Johnson. She left the group a while back?
Yes. She was ill, and she could no longer travel.
Yeah.
We heard from her. We know possibly where
she's
she
in
is.
Texas.
I think she's in Texas right now.
And Althelgra Gabriel, who sings with you now.
Yeah, yes. Thelgra Neville Gabriel. She's the sister of the Neville brothers.
Oh.
The Nevilles and the Hawkins are kind of connected because we used to live near each other in the Calio Project before they moved uptown to Valence Street.
I want to ask you about the song, probably go out on this song, Iko Iko. The story I heard is that you were in a recording session?
Yes,
correct.
We were.
what happened exactly?
Well, the band was taking a break, and we were in there, Joan, Rosa, and myself, and there was an aluminum chair, some drumsticks, Coca-Cola, which all these years Coca-Cola should have come up and helped us out, you know, because we talk about them all the time. Mm. We use their Coke bottle, drumsticks, and ashtray, and we started drumming and singing. We didn't know that Jerry and Mike were still in the control room.
These are Jerry.
Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller.
Yeah, these are famous guys.
They were
guys.
The producers of Redbirds. Yeah.
Exactly.
So they were still in there, and they turned the tapes on, and they said, hey, girls, do that again. So we did. So before you know it, that's how Iko was born.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm going to set your flag on fire. You're talking about hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now. Iko, Iko, Andy.
A delight talking to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank
Same
you
here,
so much
thank
for, having
you for having us.
Barbara and Rosa Hawkins, the Dixie Cups, speaking with us from Tampa.
I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Chuckle movie, I made. Talking about henna, 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 henna. I go one day.
We're returning now to NPR South correspondent Joe Palca, who joins us in our studios today as we're following the progress of Hurricane Rita. And NPR's Joe, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Scott.
And NPR's John Hamilton at the National Hurricane Center in Miami. John, thank you for joining us. And what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that Hurricane Rita continues to move slowly onshore. It has weakened. The forecasters here are now saying it's a Category 2 storm. And by the end of the day, it probably won't be a hurricane at all.
Mm-hmm. When they say it's been downgraded to a Category 2 storm, there's still plenty of punch there, isn't there?
Well, Category 2 can go up to 110 miles an hour of wind, so yes, there's plenty of punch there. Although the major concern at this point is not wind, but water. You have continued storm surge throughout the day, and then you have torrential rainfall.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, causes flooding.
Which, of course, causes flooding. In coastal areas, you're going to get flooding from both sources. You're going to have abnormally high tides up to 15 feet above normal, which will bring seawater in, and then you're going to have 10 to 15 inches of rain, which will bring a huge freshwater flooding, as they call it.
Joe Palca has a question.
John, I just was wondering, how satisfied are the forecasters down at the Hurricane Center with their ability to track this? It came in pretty close to where they were expecting, or were they off by a bit?
It came in real close to where they were expecting. They were talking about Port Arthur area being near the center of the hurricane, and as near as I can tell from looking at the track, that's exactly where it came. One thing that's a little misleading is that what happens here is they give a cone, a probability range, and say it won't land beyond this level or beyond this place or this place, and they don't pretend to say they know exactly where it's going. The trouble is that people draw a line right down the middle of that, and they judge the forecasters here by whether it was exactly on that line.
Mm-hmm. John, what are they going to be watching, let's say, over the next hour in particular for signs about how destructive this storm will be?
They're going to be watching a couple of things. One of them will be the continued storm surge. Now, even as the winds decrease, you can have tropical storm force winds, which can cause a significant storm surge. And so around the coast, where you have bays and rivers, now you've had reports that tide levels may be 15 feet above normal, and in some places, you can get even higher than that because the water gets pushed into a narrowed space and you can get maybe 20 feet or more. So they're watching the storm surge. And the other thing they're going to be watching is whether, as this storm moves inland, it stops. They're very concerned that it's going to hit a high-pressure ridge and just stop and drop a whole lot of rain.
Mm-hmm. And we should note, this is not the end of hurricane season, is it? We still have several weeks to go.
That is correct. Now technically the storm season, the hurricane season, runs through November, but most of the action will take place by the end of October. And they were saying here yesterday that they would not be at all surprised to see several more storms during the year.
Okay. NPR's John Hamilton, who's at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, thank you for joining us. Joe Palca, thank you for joining us. We're going to continue here on Weekend Edition and other NPR news programs to continue to cover the progress of Hurricane Rita as it continues onshore. And we will follow that throughout the morning and throughout today. So you are listening to live coverage. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
And this is WBUR. Our weather forecast is calling for sunshine today. It's going to be much cooler with highs only in the 60s. Tonight, clear and lows going down into the 40s. Tomorrow, we'll see sunshine in the morning, clouds developing in the afternoon, highs tomorrow in the low 70s. And for Monday, clouds, a chance of showers, and temperatures in the upper 70s. Right now, it's 60 degrees in Boston. Stay with us for more Weekend Edition Saturday and our special coverage of Hurricane Rita. It's coming up on 8 o'clock.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, celebrating their 30th year in business, Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick. More in-